This is the Doctor, President-elect of the High Council of Time Lords, keeper of the legacy of Rassilon, defender of the laws of time, protector of Gallifrey.
I will not forget your line of this. Not one day.
Like many scientists, I'm afraid the Rani simply sees us as walking heaps of chemicals. There's no place for the soul in her scheme of things.
You are absolute idiots.
We are not idiots. We want to go home.
Yes, home.
I am Dr. Idiot.
Smith. Dr. John Smith.
Get off my world.
They're human beings, if that's what you mean, indulging their favorite pastime, trying to destroy each other.
Cancel the destination.
Countermand it.
Cancel the destination.
Countermand it.
I'm going to kill you in a minute.
Don't blink. Don't even blink. Blink and you're dead.
I say, what a wonderful butler. He's so violent.
Excellent. Absolutely exquisite.
The Last Christmas, 2015 now. This is January. We're recording. What's today's date? On the 3rd.
Yeah.
It's snowing outside. So we have all three of us via, what's the name of this program?
Jitsi.
Jitsi.
J-I-T-S-I.
So welcome to the Who's On podcast. This is a special edition, a Christmas special that we're doing. And not only that, but all three of us are now via something else. Now, we usually sit in a room, two of us, and then one via Skype. We don't even have Skype going on right now.
No.
Not that you can see us.
But you can hear the difference, so that's what it comes down to.
As long as they are entertained.
Yeah.
So, listeners, this is our how many installments now? 32nd installment of the Who's On Podcast?
Yeah, pretty close to that, if not that. Yeah, it's, let's see, I can actually tell you the answer in about 2 seconds, or maybe a little bit more than that, but this is number 32.
Wow.
Installment 32.
We've been doing podcasts now for almost 2 years.
Yeah, we've been doing it for a little while.
March 2013 when we started.
Mm-hmm.
Or February or something like that, but anyway. Dan is in Pennsylvania. Rob and I are in New Jersey. We're in the country of the United States of America. So we are three American Doctor Who fans and have been for our entire lives. Well, me since I was 8. And Rob since you were how old?
Probably around there. Maybe a little bit older. Maybe like 10. But it's pretty early on, too.
And Dan, you've been watching since when?
5 or 6.
Wow, so we're going back to the 70s and early 80s, peoples.
Mm-hmm.
And with that mindset, with that hindsight, because we are all classic Doctor Who fans, try to bring you guys a little something different, our way of seeing something. Like, okay, an example here. I heard the word sleepers in this. There's 4 sleepers, and immediately I'm thinking Savalon Glitz, I'm thinking Trial of a Time Lord, because this is a Doctor Who term that we've heard before.
Right.
But anyway, we'll get into that. Dan, do you have details on the episode? Who directed it? Who wrote the episode?
Yes, I have information here. Obviously, Stephen Moffat, this is his 4th or 3rd? No, it'll be his 4th, because he's done 3 with Matt Smith. This is his 4th Doctor Who Christmas special. It was directed by Paul Wilmhurst. Let's see what else he's done. He's probably done other Doctor Who. Oh, he directed Kill the Moon and The Mummy on the Orient Express. And guest stars?
Yeah, I would love it.
Yes, Nick Frost as Santa Claus.
Mm-hmm.
Dan Starkey, who also plays Strax, is an elf called Ian. Faye Marseille, who apparently is on a show called The White Queen, which I have not seen. playing Shona McCulloch. Natalie Gamede plays Ashley. Maureen Beattie plays Fiona. And Michael Troughton plays Professor Albert Smythe.
Uh-huh. Woohoo! And who is he?
Michael Troughton is, I think, the youngest son of Patrick Troughton.
Okay.
Yes, he is.
Or at least he's the younger of two sons that have gone into acting, at least. Because David Troughton is the other one. And David Troughton, I think, first appeared in the War Games as a
soldier,
Union
Confederate
soldier. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
And then he later played King Paladin during John Pertwee's era.
And then he was also in the episode.
Midnight or?
Yeah, it's Midnight.
He was in the new series. I forget which one.
He was in Midnight.
Was it?
Yes. He played the professor, the know-it-all professor, who told his understudy to shut up.
Yes, it was Midnight. Okay, so I was right.
So David Tennant and, I was going to say Donna Noble, Catherine Tate episode.
Well, Catherine Tate as Donna Noble.
Yeah.
You know, people's real names and their character names are interchangeable. We don't need to worry about that.
There's this funny seeing him in this episode, too, because, first of all, he was chomping down on a turkey leg the whole time. So he was actually called out on it. But whenever he spoke, I mean, he spoke and he sounded like his dad, too.
Mm.
And I thought that was really cool.
Yeah.
That bridge. But this episode, what did you guys think? Overall,
I thought it was pretty good. You know, it's for a Christmas episode. I'm a little bit weird about the way it tied into the season, but it kind of hinted at some of the things that we had alluded to earlier, that maybe a dream, you know, and they kind of added to that a little bit more because the doctor kept waking up in what looked like he was probably sitting next to the lava in Clara's dream state. I'm sure we'll get more into the whole dream within dreams thing, but it just seemed like it was leading into a lot of that stuff, which I guess we'll see how it plays into next season and how it relates back to this past one.
No, that's an interesting observation about where exactly he woke up from. Because my wife and I were trying to figure it out. Sorry, Dan.
Yeah, I was just going to say it seemed like it was the volcano setting where mm-hmm. Clara took him with the TARDIS keys.
Mm-hmm. Which, again, was, you know, in that situation, technically she was supposed to be in a dream state with the little thing that she had. So that, you know, so is the point that the doctor has actually been in this dream state this whole time? You know, maybe, Danny should be dead because that all happened after Danny's death, but, you know, I guess we'll see how it goes.
Very interesting. So this one is pretty modern compared to a lot of the other Christmas episodes. We've had the Victorian episode, the Edwardian episode. We've had, what was the one last? The Narnia one.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And so this one was very modern. And it was modern, yet it was holiday and Christmas and Santa Claus, of course. I mean, Nick Frost, first of all, the name Nick Frost, he's St. Nick.
yeah.
It was really funny. And he played such a great Peter Capaldi and Nick Frost together, I thought, had such a wonderful dynamic. Similar to the dynamic that Jenna Louise and Peter Capaldi have, where they just sort of seem to be able to play off each other they butt heads well.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
And Peter Capaldi has that, like early on when the Robin Hood episode, he was able to play that kind of thing too. Yeah. I love the way he deals with other people. Maybe it goes back to his time on his program, you know, where we can't swear kind of thing. because I thought this episode was creepy. It was deep. It was disturbing. And then the monster, the Contrafari or whatever, however it was pronounced, I don't particularly remember, kind of reminded me of the Curse of Fenric. When they came up, they had that kind of face.
Hmm.
He's like, monsters and the dream crafts that just kind of grabbed the face. That is really freaky.
Mm-hmm.
And I was really creeped out by the episode.
Well, I got a kick out of it, even making the blatant reference to facehuggers from Alien. You know, they look like facehuggers. No bones about it.
Oh, I do have a note on that. It's like, you mean you have a movie called Alien? He's like, no wonder people keep trying to take you over. You're asking for it, kind of thing.
Yeah, it was a good line.
Yeah, he found it very offensive that they named the horror movie Alien.
I have it somewhere in here, but oh well. And so, this is the 10th straight Christmas episode since the series opened in 2005, so we've had 10. And I know that there was the 1965 Stephen Regret one, you know, too, but it wasn't really a tradition until Russell T.
Right.
And now I can't think of Christmas without it.
It's true. Yeah, it is part of, you know, especially for Doctor Who fans, it is definitely part of the season. You just wait for it.
And I liked how they tied into the season. Because this season, I was thinking back, I mean, look at the director. He directed Kill the Moon and Mummy on the Orient Express, two really very successful stories. Mm-hmm. They really worked well within the arc of the season. And this, they tied in the lying, and I was really impressed with that. How it didn't seem like it was detached, like a lot of the Christmas episodes. They really tried to weave it in, and they had to admit, well, I just left because I thought you and Danny were going to live happily ever after. And then she was like, well, I kind of just accepted that because I thought you were going to go into Gallifrey and live happily ever after. And they had to fess up.
Yeah.
So there was that whole lying part of the season that was taken in again.
Most of the Christmas specials tend to be very light and stand on their own and make sort of, you know, entertainment for the family while they're recovering from their Christmas dinner kind of thing, where this really tied in, though, like a continuation of the series. It was definitely more attached than the other stories. I actually felt that this Christmas special was the best one since A Christmas Carol, which I think is probably my favorite Christmas special. I'm not saying it's necessarily better, but I think along the same lines for me. And I found it surprisingly creepy because I wasn't expecting a Christmas. I know the British have a tradition of ghost stories for Christmas, but I was surprised at the creepy factor in this one.
And apparently tangerines too, which is not an American tradition.
Yeah, that I didn't know anything about.
Yeah, no, nobody likes the tangerines.
Nuts and tangerines.
Oh, nuts and
tangerines.
You get
nuts and tangerines in England. You get nuts and tangerines in your stocking. I remember.
Nuts. Yeah, he mentioned nuts also.
So is that like in place of coal, or that's like actually what you get in the stocking?
No, you get candy, but then you get nuts and a tangerine in the bottom of your stocking. It's a tradition.
I like how she's.
Now, why do you know this?
Because I used to get it every single year of my life in the bottom of my stocking.
And why is that?
I was going to say because.
That's right.
What I love is when she said candy, she flipped over to the English accent.
I did?
You totally did. You totally did.
I'm American.
My mother-in-law's So we have, we start off the episode with Santa on the roof trying to play off that he's just roofing guy and doing roof things and Nick Frost and Dan Starkey, who plays Strax, and he's played Commander Score too, but he's known as Strax. The elves talking about elf racism and human and the jokes were really funny and they were really spot on, and the humor in this episode interweaved with the creepiness that was really very unexpected, I thought. And so Clara and the doctor kind of like, the doctor materializes on top of Clara's roof. And so we start off with Santa on the roof. And so we've already seen Santa before he comes and saves the day in their other dream. I was going to say, that's not us on this side.
No, Lionel Lato just freaked out, so.
Which was, it was neat the way everything was intertwined. And I love stories that involve dreaming because I'm a lucid dreamer. And so when I see other people who have similar experiences and tell the story about it, I could tell stories about dreams all day. And so this, where you actually see a little bit of the,
the plot where it doesn't really connect, but it kind of fits. It's a long story, is the way that, and when they actually used that phrase, it's a long story, they knew that something else was up.
Yeah.
And so I like Peter Capaldi mentioned that dreams follow their own kind of logic. How they suddenly just appeared, you know, at the North Pole. It's like, why did they go there to begin with? You know, it's just one of the things where when you're in a dream, you just arrive in places. And because it's following its own logic, you don't notice that it's wrong or that it shouldn't be happening.
Yeah, he had the comment when they were all talking about the ice cream pain at their temple. He said, have you ever woken up from a dream and discovered you were still dreaming? Dreams within dreams. Mm-hmm. And I've had that where I've gotten ready for work. You know, you don't want to go to the bathroom accidentally.
No.
But you've gotten ready for work. You've had breakfast. You've brushed your teeth. You're already out the door, and boom, you wake up and you have to do it all over again.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
You know, where I guess because your brain prepares you for things that you do. So they say, like, I've seen. Okay, I have a confession to make. I do like television stuff that's about dreams. So I've watched some, like, science things about dreams, too. So they had one of these scientists guy, a researcher, I guess, had this guy playing this skiing game. And he was doing okay. He was learning it and doing better. He had him go into a room. He slept for, like, 6-7 hours. He came back out and he went and played it again, and he was much better at it. And the kid said because he had been playing it for so long before he went to sleep, he started dreaming about it.
Right.
And dreams have a way of preparing you for the things that are going to happen in life. So some people believe, and some civilizations, or I guess colonies believe, tribes, that's the word, tribes believe that it can actually predict the future sometimes. And sometimes people follow their dreams and make decisions based on what they have. Do you guys have any of that similar kind of stuff? I know we're not talking about Doctor Who, we're talking about dreaming, but...
Well, I know I've had... I'd like to call them... It's weird, I've called the one or two that I've had, I call them waking dreams instead of going by lucid dreams, because I think of some of the... I kind of think of, like, some of the sci-fi I've read and stuff like that, and there are certain dreams that for some reason have stuck with me more than other lucid dreams. You know, like, you know, lucid dream is one thing where you think about it, but then I've had others where there was more to it than just a regular lucid dream. You know, almost more like there was more of a story to it, like almost more like it was written. You know, I don't know how to describe it other than that, but there's been somewhere I can look back at what happened in that dream, and I can kind of see where it might have actually been, like, prescient, you know. Might have actually been kind of telling me a little bit about what was going to happen in my life without saying it blatantly. So, I don't know.
Dan?
I know when I was younger, I would have dreams within dreams. Times when I thought I was awake. Also, that comes from being young and getting... like a high fever, and you get those hallucinatory dreams. Those are pretty freaky, and those have stuck with me. A couple of nightmares that I've had. And actually, the whole chalkboard thing in this one, where, like, Clara's name was showing up, I had a dream when I was sick, I believe. I used to have a chalkboard at the foot of my bed, and in the dream, text was scrolling across the chalkboard. And it's something I still remember, and it, like, really freaked me out. And I had that night terror thing, the thing where you think that there's, like, something sitting on your back and that you're paralyzed and you can't move.
Oh, that's scary.
I think that's considered a night terror or something like that when I was really young.
Yeah, where there's almost, like, not physical manifestations.
Not so much now. I mean, I think now I seem to have more control over my dreams. I'm more aware that I'm dreaming when I'm doing it. So, especially if I'm dreaming about work, I'll be like, I'm dreaming about work, I'm not doing that. And so I'll change the dream. You know, it's like, it's bad enough that I have to do it. But when I'm dreaming about having a terrible day at work, I won't allow it.
It's like, get me out. Just get me out of this.
Yeah. I'll deliberately, like, force myself out of it. So, in a way, like, my subconscious has a certain amount of control. A lot of my dreams seem to play like movies, just because I watch a lot of movies, I think, where it's sort of like my eye is a camera. But I'm just a camera. I'm not actually there. So I'm, like, sort of, like, playing things back or something like that.
Oh, interesting. So you're the fly on the wall.
Yeah, sometimes.
Hey, I actually one time had a dream that I was... that it was a Tom Baker's companion with Chris Corky Burke.
Oh, I know Dan's had dreams with doctors too.
Yeah, yeah.
Once where Peter Davison showed up at a Doctor Who party.
Oh.
And he was like, and he was talking to people, and he was pretty nice, and he just started giving people money. I don't know.
Okay.
He was like my dad all of a sudden. And he started like, here, have some money.
Okay. That sounds like
and
fun.
I once dreamt that I met Matt Smith and Arthur Darvill. And Matt Smith was exactly the way he is in all the videos and stuff. And Arthur Darvill didn't want to be there, but he was trying to be nice, but he wanted to be somewhere else.
Yeah, yeah.
So, Dan, when you saw the part with Clara on the chalkboard dying and that kind of stuff going on, so, because you've had dreams like that, did that especially freak you out?
Yeah, that was... Especially when you had the one chalkboard, and then she turns around, and the whole hallway is filled with them.
I love the way they shot that.
That really, like...
Her face, the whole, like, her head and her body were there, and they were sort of like she was, like, up in the air almost, and the way the camera panned back, it was really
That was
neat.
Like the Alfred Hitchcock camera technique from Vertigo, where the camera is pulling back while zooming in simultaneously, and it gives this sort of weird, like, you're coming forward and going back at the same time effect.
Yeah.
Yeah, like Jimmy Stewart on the bell tower.
Yeah.
I was going to say something else about... Oh, yeah. I love how like the doctor comes up with the way to end the thing. He's like, this is the shared dream. So we have to, when they're surrounded by everybody, we just have to rescue ourselves, basically. He's like, you all know you're dreaming. So now you have superpowers. That's what a dream is. That's what, when I say lucid dreaming, that, I mean, I've flown, I've gone through walls, I've been able to go into, like, dive into the, like, black holes almost where no one can see me. Because I'm always, like, evading something. Either some government agency that wants to expose, doesn't want their stuff exposed, or, I don't know, there's all sorts of stuff, like, you know, police who, or I'm saving somebody, little girls up in places that are being abused, and just all sorts of different scenarios. And as a lucid dreamer, you're able to, like they say, when you die in your dream, you really die. I've died in my dreams plenty of times, and I've come back. You know, I've actually gotten my dead body up and then beat the thing that killed me. And I remember just recently I had a dream where someone looked at me and said that they had me, and I said, oh, no, you don't, and I woke up. Yeah, it was just really weird that some dreams are, but like when they were, I guess Michael Troughton, they said he's gonna wake up dead because he got killed. He didn't have the wherewithal to be able to beat the thing that's on him. And I like
that. That is quite interesting. That. His character, being the son of Patrick Troughton, was the one that was killed off. At least, supposedly. I mean, we don't know for sure.
Yeah, because if it was still within a dream, I mean, you know.
Yeah. I mean, the doctor was only guessing at what happened to him.
Yeah.
So the doctor was really in, and how deep, he was the longest that was, I guess it was because the crab attacked him on the lava thing. That everyone that else was in real time?
That would seem to be because he saw Santa Claus at the end of Dark Water. So that That infers to me that he was already in the dream sequence at the end of that episode.
Yeah.
He was in the TARDIS in that episode.
Yeah.
And then he was on the lava.
Well, that's why, we got to sit there and start to consider, is then the whole situation's got nothing to do with the dream crabs then, right? Probably got something more to do with, maybe Clara did actually, smack him with that little dream stamp thing. You know, we don't even know yet for sure, but could have been something like that.
Interesting.
You know, because like we were saying, if he's actually, if he's waking up in the volcano, because that's where he keeps waking up. So either that's the place he least wants to be. The way I would portray it is that that's the last place he would want to be, so that's the natural place that he would wake up first.
At least in the dream. It's extraordinary. I love the way Moffat wrote this episode. I was negative on Moffat before the season started because I thought the last two seasons of Matt Smith were really kind of lame.
Mm-hmm.
They had their strong points, but I was kind of disappointed overall. Clara's character has just evolved. I don't want her to leave, and I'm glad if she's going to stay.
Mm-hmm.
I was really happy when I saw that announcement at the end that Clara's going to stay, and I was a Clara detractor.
Yeah.
Yeah, I remember.
I'd be okay with it working back out with her, because like you said, I do like the way her character's developed, but at the same time, I kind of feel like if you played it out to end the way it did, let it play that way. I mean, how long has the Doctor been asleep? Maybe he's actually still Peter Davison and Adric's not dead. Kind of like we've made the joke before about bringing people back, I mean, who knows? But I don't know. I could really take it either way, I guess. Again, when the season starts up again, we'll see how it plays out and,
Yeah.
It's Doctor Who I'll enjoy no matter what.
And I like how Danny's character in this episode, Clara's envisioning of him was really Danny, mm-hmm. not just Clara's envisioning of him. That was just interesting how they made his character within Clara's dream, because he was a made-up character because it was Clara who was dreaming dead Danny.
Mm-hmm.
But Danny seemed to have a mind of his own in the dream. And he said, no, I didn't save everybody. I saved Clara. You all got lucky.
Hmm.
Yeah, and he's like, and then the doctor said brave, and he's like, it's not bravery, I'm already dead.
Yeah.
Yeah, there was a few times where the doctor has been so impressed with Danny, and this was another one where it wasn't really Danny, but he was acting independent of Clara, it seemed.
Yeah.
Yeah, I agree. It's almost like it was actually Danny, and he was like meeting her in a dream.
And, which is a nice, I like the whole, the doctor said third-party perception, mind piracy, hacking the optic nerve. Again, we hear the optic nerve. I think that's like the fourth or fifth time this season that mm-hmm. the optic nerve has been mentioned.
Yeah, it's been something like that.
And then, for the non-classic Doctor Who fan, the sleepers, originally when I mentioned the sleepers, It's an old Doctor Who term from Savalon Glitz. In the Trial of a Time Lord, a Colin Baker episode, the first one of Trial of a Time Lord, Savalon Glitz mentions the sleepers nicking off the secrets. And I think it would be really... I thought when the episode was going, I was like, oh my goodness, they're bringing something like that back in Doctor Who lore. They were taking technology and selling it off to different... planets.
Mm-hmm.
And wouldn't it be interesting if the sleepers really were dreamers who could go into a place and steal something, remember it from a dream, and then bring it back with them, like in their mind, like code and things like that? Because that's what it seemed like way back when. Thoughts?
It makes me actually kind of think about Danny having been in some of that Matrix piece. If he was uploaded into that part of the Matrix core database thing, whatever.
Gallifreyan hard drive.
Yeah. If he was uploaded into that, and if he was able to communicate with Clara, what if maybe part of the reason he was so much himself in Clara's dream is because maybe part of him is with her? you know, maybe some kind of weird interface took place with that when he was in there and when he was communicating to her through the computers. I don't know. But, and, you know,
Clara's also been inside the Great Intelligence too, mm-hmm. with the Matt Smith episode.
Yeah. That's, you know, there, with the fact that he's played with so much of that lore, so much of that Doctor Who Gallifreyan tech, you know, could pretty much really do anything with it at this point. He could probably just make up something completely out of nowhere and we could find justification for it.
Oh, like I say, everything's connected to Doctor Who.
Exactly, exactly. If it's not Star Trek, it's Doctor Who, so.
Well, that reminds me, Dan was telling me some funny Star Trek thing yesterday. But I love when Peter Capaldi smiles.
Yes.
I have to say, I think that evil grin that he has is, it's evil and fun at the same time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
it's sarcastic. There's so many things that play across his face when he smiles as the Doctor.
Yeah, yeah.
It's by
the way, when the grumpy cat thing, yeah, the grumpy cat thing on the Facebook page.
Oh, with the eyebrows.
Brilliant. Yeah, the angry eyebrows on the grumpy cat. Perfect.
They thought that the episode was over when they first all woke up.
Yeah.
And the Doctor just like, all right, bye. And he just leaves. And then he comes back and is like, are you all the same people? Like, yeah. Sorry, I deleted you.
Yeah. Yeah. Sorry, I wiped you out, but we're back.
And the whole the childishness of the Doctor really came out. You really haven't seen Capaldi do that very much, but when he was driving the sleigh himself, and he was just like, look at me, look at me.
Oh, I thought that was so cornball, but at the same time...
It was.
It was, but it was funny.
But that's exactly what I would think, you know. It's like the Doctor, would, if offered the chance to drive Santa's sleigh, he would totally do it.
I think it's
almost
really...
like a Matt Smith moment in my mind. It's sort of like childish excitement that Matt Smith's Doctor would have that you really haven't seen much of in Capaldi's take on
it's,
it.
That's true, yeah.
But
he
it's
had
when
a
like,
bit
the grumpiness
got...
is peeled away and he's just really enjoying himself.
Yeah, it was nice to see him just kind of inheriting a little bit of that because he was able to have a little bit of fun with it, I think, in a different way than he has before.
A quote that I love from this episode. I love quotes. I love stringing quotes together. I love audio. I love that kind of thing from movies or even from books and stuff like that. You know what the big problem is with telling fantasy and reality apart? They're both ridiculous.
I love that. Yeah. That was excellent.
Moffat has some really poignant perceptiveness, I think. And he's really writing at a high clip. For this Capaldi season, and I thought that between some of the story arcs from this season 8, that I mean we've been through it in the Death of Heaven all the story arc stuff, but between the lying and the surrendering, where sometimes you have to lose control and just surrender, and that's when you actually gain, that's when you win, that. And then Clara, when just the quote when Clara betrayed him, and the way he handled that, I think is, such a great message for the population. And Doctor Who fans will get it. Other people who don't watch Doctor Who won't get it. And I think that when you're paying attention as a Doctor Who fan, it really does. Give you something else to think about mentally, where normal life and normal reading usually doesn't. And I think Moffat has really done a good job in allowing me, I'll be personal here, to see things from a little different angle, where the perception's a little bit different. And it's opened me up, I'll give him credit and I guess my overall age process. Credit into just letting things be
and not overthinking things, and just allowing things to fall into place of their own natural and free state, rather than trying to force an issue or, you know, or anything like that. And I think it's an important message. And as I've gotten older, I've seen that. I didn't want it to become about me, but I've seen that things matter less when you have your priorities straight.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of stuff that people stress over that just aren't important. And I think that's one of the messages that Moffat's been trying to send this season, with the surrendering being a big part of that.
I agree. I agree with you on both fronts. That when you focus on getting your priorities in the order that, you know, they need to be for yourself, then a lot of the other junk just kind of falls away.
And I think Stephen Moffat's, maybe it's his kids that have done that to him over the past few years. His children are little, and he's been the show's producer for 5 years now.
Hmm.
And I hope he continues. And I hope that he can transfer some of those things that he's learned from his kids over to the show. You know, that I'm just guessing, hazarding a guess, but who knows?
Well, I think maybe, you know, the whole idea of maturity ties into an older doctor, too. The show. I mean, you have an older, more mature actor playing the doctor, so... And in ways, it seems like the scripts themselves reflect that, and there's like a maturity to them.
I agree, but then again, Matt Smith did play an older doctor the way he played
like a young man, or an old man in a young man's body.
Yeah,
but it's one thing to be playing it where Peter Capaldi is.
Yeah.
He's not playing a role. He is older, so. And I don't know, every doctor has played their role differently. And while Matt Smith, I like Matt Smith a lot. And, he played it that way. Capaldi, in my mind, is almost, you know, more of a throwback to a classic era doctor, where Matt Smith's performance, I'd still, maybe just because he was young, group him in with the, you know, like the new generation. Sort of like what John Hurt was in the 50th anniversary, where he was like a bridge. And it feels like Capaldi's on the other side of the bridge, on the John Hurt side. And not saying that...
I liked the dreamy weenie joke that they threw in.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that was good.
I loved all the little digs that Santa did.
Yeah.
Basically suggesting that the doctor couldn't be real, either, any more real than he is.
Or, the magician. The
whole thing where Shone is like grilling him with questions. And then
the doctor's
like, well, answer me this. How do you get all those presents on your sleigh? It's like bigger on the inside. And then the elves are like, ooh.
Yeah. The elves are really funny. I got the feels. Shona was a really great character. I love Shona. Mm-hmm. I hope that Shona becomes a companion. She wanted to exchange numbers, and she mm-hmm. seemed like someone who was really cool, but yet didn't have friends for some reason.
Some have suggested on certain forums that she may have been written in a way where if Jenna Coleman had decided to leave at the end...
That she could have been...
That she was going to be the replacement that was going to be introduced. But because Jenna changed her mind. Seemed like to me that Jenna... when Matt Smith left, Jenna was like, yes, I'm definitely leaving. But she had so much fun with Peter Capaldi. Because you can see the chemistry that that they have together on and off the screen.
And yeah, ever since...
I think she changed her mind.
Ever since the restaurant stream, half-man face.
That was really
face.
The first scene with the two of them that you could see how they clicked.
I actually think they got... I actually find that they have better chemistry than she ever had with Matt Smith.
I agree.
I don't know if it's because you expected like a romance thing with Matt Smith, but it never happened. But versus now, you wouldn't see that ever.
Every doctor kind of has a companion that they really mesh with. I felt like David Tennant. It was Donna.
Yeah.
And
can't be controlled, whereas Matt Smith was controllable. And so I think the dynamic there with Clara, because Clara being the one who wanted to be in charge, and Matt Smith would just kind of go along with it because he was intrigued by her because she's impossible. But Peter Capaldi, he can't really be controlled. He has a mind of his own. He has a will of his own, and he doesn't go for that. And I think that dynamic Jenna had to adapt to it. And I love that process that we've seen. And she could be the doctor. She responds to some people as if she were the doctor as well. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, I'm not a beginner here. You know, don't talk to me like I'm stupid.
Even like Santa and the elves at the beginning, she tells them to shut up like the doctor does.
Yeah.
Like, shut up.
Yeah, yeah. I got a kick out of that one. Notice that right away, too, that she, straight up Capaldi response as far as that's
concerned. She's like using his own vocabulary.
And that's a kind of thing that you saw with Second Romana and Tom Baker, too, where the Second Romana became more and more like Tom.
Yeah, I agree. She was even wearing, like, her own little scarf in some of the stories.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And the trench coat, the pink trench coat with the white scarf.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
And Clara's not a screamer, and she screamed in this episode.
Yeah.
And I thought that was really good, because it wasn't a Mel high-pitched, blow-my-ears-out scream either. It was a real scream, not just a scream for the sake of the scream.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
Not where the director said, hey, Mel, why don't you scream again? You know, but this time Clara was screaming out of necessity, out of, oh my God, this face hugger is about to come at me.
Yeah, yeah.
And speaking of Shona, and speaking of, you know, face huggers and screaming, I like the fact that when Shona wakes up at the end and she pulls out her Christmas to-do list, basically breaks down, like, everything that happens in the Christmas special. And like, and I like her DVD selection. Like, she starts out with a couple of horror movies with Alien and the Thing from Another Planet. Mm-hmm. And then her dad's going to come over, and then she's going to watch Miracle on 34th Street with him. I don't get the Forgive Dave reference, though. That one.
Yeah, from Another World. Yeah, and then the Game of Thrones marathon.
Oh, yeah, well, because the War of the Roses was a strong influence on Game of Thrones, and because she was in that White Queen series where she plays I forget which character that she plays. I did a quick look up. I haven't seen.
Yeah, so did I on her.
So it's sort of like a reference to her own career as well. So I thought that was like a nice in joke. And I don't know if Dave is a reference to something else that I just don't get either.
I think it was kind of almost a little bit of a wasted scenario where the doctor and Clara were saying we could all be from different times, yet
yeah.
They're all from what looked to be the same time. I was kind of a little bit let down by that, because that would have been interesting to have them be broken up. But I guess at the same time, if it was somebody from the past, like they wouldn't have been acting like that. So I don't know. But it was
nice. I like the every Christmas is last Christmas kind of thought process too, where you usually see people you don't see all year.
Mm-hmm.
You know, who are family, who do share some of your genetic code.
Mm-hmm. And you do never know what's going to happen during the course of the year. If it's only one time a year get together,
yeah,
that's, you know, the 364 days where anything could happen.
So you're a dream that's trying to save us, Shona. I think you just described me. Mm-hmm. I thought it was neat.
Yeah,
given the true history of Saint Nick.
Mm-hmm.
I love the only reliable dream test, and I'll come to a close with this. They all have four different manuals, and they all read off the first word after a page is set. It was 57, 24, and 12,
I think. Yeah, I think so. It was something along
those lines. Memory serves. Very, very, very dead.
Yeah. Shona got chocolate. It's like, why did I get chocolate?
Yeah.
Where I guess these crabs would stick an anesthetic as they're sucking the brain. And so that's where the ice cream frozen feeling at the temple was, like them sucking out the brain. So they knew they were still dreaming whenever they had that going on.
That's a nice little thing, kind of like taking like a common thing where you get like a headache or something like that, and making it scary. That's something Stephen Moffat does very well. And so now kids, whenever they have a headache, they're going to be thinking that they might be dreaming.
Brain freeze. Like yep.
Yeah, that goes back all the way to like John Pertwee with the plastic and the autons, you know.
Mm-hmm. Trying to seeing mummies in the window. Yeah.
So I thought that was really neat. It was a great episode. Time travel is always possible in dreams.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. And I think that I can't wait for next season. Clara left with, I've always believed in Santa Claus, but he looks a little different to me, and hugging Peter Capaldi.
Yeah.
It was really nice. I had the feels on that one. And the doctor's wish to come back earlier, and Santa arrives, wakey wakey. And he gives the doctor his last wish. Wherever he woke up from, I think that's an interesting theory on the lava in Clara's dream.
Yeah, I got to double check. I don't remember where the last thing is that they showed him wake up. Or did they ever show him wake up that final time?
They showed him up in the TARDIS, sitting on a chair. Like Matt Smith sat on that same chair, sort of exasperated at times. And looking older.
Mm-hmm.
And he was asleep there. But we'll see, you know, where it leads. Because I'm excited with this season. I wonder what they're going to do with Danny Pink. You know, whether... Because they kind of inferred that Clara has seen him with less than two layers of clothing on. So we have to wonder where what's his name? Orson Pink came from. If he's just a part of a possible timeline branch off, or if he is a reality somewhere.
Well, they do say, I mean, that's the one thing I've thought about a couple times, thinking about some of the stuff they did, is that didn't they technically, when they closed off that other dimension with the other Mickey and stuff like that, weren't they kind of saying that we're not going to run into alternate timelines anymore? Because didn't they kind of establish then that that would be separate? Or are we going to have to look older and
see? But we had the whole crack in the time, the fabric of space and time.
Yeah, that's true. All bets are off of that too anyway, so that's true.
But who knows? I mean, East Space is always possible, you know, as well, where we've been. We are in the end space. For non-classic Doctor Who fans, it's Full Circle, I think it starts. No, Warrior's
Gate. No, Full Circle is the first one.
Oh, okay.
And then Warrior's State Gate. Of Decay, and then Warrior's Gate.
Mm-hmm. Right. All excellent episodes. A little later on in Tom Baker's era.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
So, and then the storylines are excellent. The second Romano Lala Award is in those. But I hope you've enjoyed listening. We've enjoyed discussing this episode. And how many TARDISes do you guys give?
I'd probably give it 3.
3 TARDISes from Ron?
Out of 5? Well,
yeah, out of 5 TARDISes. So you really weren't, like all like Christmas Carol second best or first best kind of thing? No, really?
No, you know, I don't know.
How come this didn't come up during the podcast?
I just, I don't know. I think there was just too much Ridley Scott influence is what it comes down to. You know, there's too much, for me, like, to watch Doctor Who, there's too much influence from other things. Like I said, too much of the, you know, the face huggers from Alien, the whole thing of, like, Dreams Within Dreams reminded me of, like, Plans Within Plans from Dune. there's just a lot of other stuff.
I mean, the North Pole was the opposite of Antarctica for the thing. But the thing I did like is he made the homages so obvious that he put them right in the scripts.
Well, exactly. Like, you know, even the reference to facehuggers.
He turned into a joke.
Yeah. I mean, it was good. It's not, I don't, you know, it's definitely like closer to four than two. But yeah, it was
3.5 TARDISes then.
Exactly. There you go.
And Dan, how about you? How many TARDISes?
I would probably put it about 4.5.
You said right at the get-go you liked it a lot, so that's
yeah. I did. Yeah. It's a five TARDISes for me. Again, Moffat just blows off the board.
Yeah, it's borderline five. I did really like it, and I liked it the second time as well.
The only thing that would hinder it was it did go a little cornball a few times.
But it's Christmas
with Santa Claus because it's Santa Claus, I guess.
Yeah,
and Nick Frost I think played a great Santa Claus.
Yeah. I agree.
He was made to play the goofy, kind of crass Santa who is a little bit angry and yet at the same time...
A little bit doctor-y. He's like a Time Lord, really.
Well, it's it really kind of was.
It's true, too.
Who knows?
And if it's the doctor's dream, then, you know, who knows how he would imagine Santa.
Yeah. So, until next time, folks, we'll hope to see you soon.
Yep. Bye-bye.
Bye.